Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, valid until proven otherwise by clear and convincing evidence edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 9th, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Microsoft Corporation versus I4I Limited Partnership. According to Section 282 of the Patent Act of 1952, a patent shall be presumed valid and the burden of establishing invalidity of a patent or any claim thereof, shall rest on the party asserting such invalidity. The question in this case is whether Section 282 requires an invalidity defense to be proved by clear and convincing evidence. In an opinion delivered by Justice Sotomayor, the court held by a vote of 8-2 that Section 282 of the Patent Act does require an invalidity defense to be proved by clear and convincing evidence. Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Kagan joined Justice Sotomayor's opinion. Justice Breyer filed a concurring opinion, which Justices Scalia and Alito joined. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Chief Justice Roberts took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Professor Adam Mossoff, who is a professor at the George Mason University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Mossoff.
Greetings, SCOTUS Cast listeners. My name is Adam Mossoff. I'm a professor of law at George Mason University School of Law. Today I'm talking about the decision in Microsoft versus I4I, which was handed down on June 9, 2011. With a unanimous opinion written by Justice Sotomayor, although Chief Justice Roberts had recused himself from the case. There were also concurrences by Justices Breyer and Thomas. Note, for those who have been following patent law cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, the Federal Circuit is doing much better this term than it has in prior years. As opposed to the many reversals over the past 4 to 5 years, the Supreme Court has handed down many affirmances this year of the Federal Circuit's decisions. This is a nice change of pace for the Federal Circuit. Now, the issues I'm going to be discussing today with respect to the Microsoft v. I4I case are, I'll provide a quick background on the relevant patent law. Second, I'll do a brief overview of the case. Third, I'll cover the decision. And then lastly, I'll address some issues raised by the case and possibly raise some other things that the listeners might want to think about. All right, so let's start. First, with respect to the patent law, and this is for any listeners who are not patent law geeks, such as myself, or who don't practice in the area or do research and writing in it. And so here's just a quick and dirty overview of patent law, just enough to understand what was going on in this case. All right, a patent is a property right in an invention, and its term is 20 years from the date of application. Now, for a patent to issue on an invention, the invention must be novel, useful, non-obvious, and it must be properly disclosed by the inventor in the patent such that other people who are skilled in that particular field of art, the technical term is a person having ordinary skill in the art, or posita, as patent lawyers call it, such that these people can make and use the invention. Also, the invention cannot be disclosed or be the subject of commercial use or sale more than 1 year before the date of the patent application itself. This is referred to as the statutory bar that's codified in Section 102B, and which was relevant in this case. Now, it's very important to know that the patent system is an examination system. It's not a registration system. And what this means is that patent applications are examined at the Patent and Trademark Office to see if they are valid or not before the PTO issues the patent. This is unlike a registration system, which is, for instance, in copyright, where there is no examination of whether it's valid or not. The copyright is issued on whatever is written. Now, defendants in infringement actions brought against them by patentees or patent owners can assert affirmative defenses that the patent is invalid. Now, Title 35 U.S. Code, Section 282, sets forth the evidentiary standard for determining when an issued patent is considered to be invalid. And Section 282 states that, quote, a patent shall be presumed valid, unquote. Now, this was part of the 1952 Patent Act, and this was the first time that Congress, in fact, codified this presumption, although it had long existed within the case law reaching back to the early 19th century. Now, Section 282 has been construed by the Federal Circuit as requiring the highest evidentiary standard imposed in civil cases, a clear and convincing standard. Now, this was expressly formulated before the Federal Circuit by Judge Rich in the 1984 decision American Hoist and Derrick Company v. Sawa and Sons, 725 F. 2nd, 1350. Now, this is very important, if only also because Judge Rich was one of the drafters of the 1952 Patent Act when it was enacted by Congress. Now, one of the points of contention between the parties in this case and among the many amici who filed supporting briefs was whether the statutory language actually requires this standard and whether the standard was consistent with the longstanding case law on the subject that has existed even prior to 1952. All right, so that's the overview of the basics of patent law. On to the case. Now, I4I owns a patent on a method for editing computer documents, and as a result, I4I sued Microsoft for infringing these patents in the ubiquitously used programs Microsoft Word. Now, Microsoft tried to attack the patent during the case by claiming that it had evidence that was not presented before the patent examiner that the statutory bar in Section 102 was violated. This evidence, however, was deemed insufficient to overcome the high standard of clear and convincing evidence being required for invalidating a patent. Now, the jury ruled in favor of I4I on willful infringement, and the Federal Circuit affirmed and rejected Microsoft's argument on appeal that the judge improperly instructed the jury on the appropriate evidentiary standard. Microsoft then filed cert, and it presented two arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. Its primary argument was that the preponderance standard should apply to all evidence of invalidity. It's a lower standard of proof. It requires only 51% to weigh in favor of the evidence rather than the much higher clear and convincing standard. It also had an alternative argument that the preponderance standard should apply at least for new evidence that was not considered by the patent examiner. So it said, okay, even if you're going to apply the clear and convincing standard, that should only apply to evidence that was before the patent examiner when the patent was being examined at the PTO before it issued the patent. And any new evidence should not get the clear and convincing standard. It should, in fact, get the preponderance of the evidence standard, a lower standard. All right, on to the Supreme Court's decision. Justice Sotomayor, writing for a unanimous court, rejected wholesale both of Microsoft's arguments. Now, what was very interesting about this case is that it presented itself as a straightforward statutory construction case, at least in terms of Justice Sotomayor's opinion and how the justices obviously thought of it. So they talked about the plain terms of the statute and whether Section 282 codified existing common law or not, and whether presumption of validity was a legal term of art or not within the statute and within the common law. And thus, they didn't pay too much attention to the policy arguments that were made by the parties in the courts below as well as before the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, one of the primary problems in treating this as a statutory construction case is that Section 282 does not set forth any standard of proof. It just says that a patent should be presumed to be valid. And thus, the Supreme Court ended up relying very heavily on Justice Cardozo's 1934 decision in RCA v. Radio Engineering Laboratories, 293 U.S. 1, as evidence that clear and convincing standard was part of the common law and patent jurisprudence before 1952. In fact, Justice Sotomayor referred to the RCA decision as, quote, authoritative, end quote. Now there, Justice Cardozo traced a century of case law that the presumption of validity for patents that have been issued by the PTO are, quote, not to be overthrown except by clear and cogent evidence, unquote. And even more importantly, in the RCA decision, Justice Cardozo directly connected this standard to the existing common law doctrine that issued patents have a, quote, presumption of validity, unquote. Thus, as a matter of statutory construction, Congress is deemed to have been assumed to have incorporated this common law standard when it enacted the 1952 Patent Act. Or as Justice Sotomayor wrote, quote, the general rule that a common law term comes with its common law meaning, unquote, applies in this case. And thus, as I said, Justice Sotomayor and the rest of the U.S. Supreme Court rejected wholesale Microsoft's arguments that the clear and convincing standard was only applied in very special circumstances or in a very limited subset of cases reaching back into the 19th century. In fact, they did not have very many pleasant things to say about this argument. For instance, Justice Sotomayor writes at one point, quote, squint as we may, we fail to see the qualifications that Microsoft purports to identify in our cases, end quote. When I read that, my response was, ouch, that had to hurt. At the end of the day, this was a straightforward statutory construction case. Sotomayor writes, quote, nothing in Section 282's text suggests that Congress meant to depart from that understanding, meaning the meaning of the clear and convincing standard, to enact a standard of proof that would rise and fall with the facts of each case, end quote. Now, concurrences were filed in support of Justice Sotomayor's decision. Justice Breyer, joined by Justices Scalia and Alito, emphasized that the clear and convincing standard really only applies to questions of fact, not law. And Justice Thomas also filed a concurrence in which he argued that he was not actually convinced that Congress was codifying a standard of proof when it enacted Section 282 in the 1952 Patent Act. But he then noted that he reached the same outcome as Justice Sotomayor because he found Section 282 to be silent on the standard of proof, and thus there was no express change to pre-existing common law rule that the clear and convincing standard was required for all evidence of invalidity that's presented by a defendant in an infringement action. Again, Justice Thomas's concurrence emphasizes how much the canons of statutory construction ended up driving the result in this case, not the patent policy arguments that have been presented by the parties. All right. On to some analysis of this decision. And I think actually there's lots of interesting issues in this case. So I'm going to make one interesting observation that doesn't apply just to patent law, it applies generally to arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court. And then three issues I'll be discussing that apply more to patent law that are raised by this case. All right. So first, the preliminary observation. And this is a very interesting observation, and that is Microsoft switched tactics between its cert petition and the merit stage. Now, at trial and on appeal before the Federal Circuit, Microsoft's primary argument was that evidence not presented to the PTO during an examination of a patent application should not receive the protection of the heightened evidentiary standard of clear and convincing. Thus, it presented a two-part argument. Evidence before the examiner at the Patent and Trademark Office should have a clear and convincing standard when represented in a trial to show that the patent should not have been issued. But that evidence that was not before the Patent and Trademark Office during the pendency of the patent application should receive a lower standard, evidentiary standard, the preponderance of evidence standard. Now, at the merit stage, Microsoft actually switched tactics, and it presumed to argue that the whole clear and convincing standard is invalid and was not actually rooted in the common law, nor was it thus codified by Congress in 1952 when it adopted Section 282 of the Patent Act. And thus, this argument that the whole clear and convincing standard is ill became, in effect, the only argument. And in other words, it bet the whole farm, and it lost badly. And that's a really risky thing to do before the U.S. Supreme Court, which is to bet the whole farm. And it did. It tried to knock out the entire clear and convincing standard, and I'll get to the policy arguments shortly as to why it tried to do that, and it lost very, very badly on those grounds. All right, so on to the patent law issues. First, I think it bears emphasizing that this case does not end the debate as to what standard of evidence should be applied to defendants who raise questions about patent validity during patent infringement lawsuits. It simply now shifts the debate to Congress. And, in fact, Congress is already on the cusp of enacting sweeping new patent legislation. In fact, the House is scheduled this week to vote on the America Invents Act. In fact, some people have already proposed language that should be amended to the America Invents Act that will apply the preponderance of evidence standard to evidence that was not presented before the examiner when the patent application was examined. In sum, this decision is not the end of this debate as to whether the clear and convincing standard should apply to patents that have issued. It simply shifts the institutional focus of this debate from the courts to the halls of Congress. Now, second, it's interesting to note that Microsoft and the many amici that filed briefs on its behalf engage in lots of policy arguments about the clear and convincing standard. The primary argument was that the PTO is just not doing its job. In fact, I sometimes think that this agency is like the Rodney Dangerfield of law. It just gets no respect. Basic argument here, lots of bad patents are being issued today, especially in computer software and business methods. And thus the argument is these patents are not deserving of the clear and convincing standard because these are bad patents. They shouldn't have been issued in the first place, and there's lots of them. The argument ultimately reaching the point that lots of bad patents being issued by the PTO ultimately hampers innovation and undermines the very purpose and grant of power to Congress in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, that it's supposed to to, quote, promote the progress of science and useful arts, unquote, by granting patents and copyrights. Thus, they argue, since lots of the bad patents are being issued by the PTO, there should be no deference for this agency's decision-making in issuing patents. Now, this is important because this argument actually raises the issue of the primary justification for the presumption of validity in modern patent jurisprudence today. And that justification is that patent system is an examination system. Patents are examined by government experts, and as federal courts have been saying since the modern examination system was set up in 1836, federal agencies are presumed to do their jobs. And thus, it was presumed that an examiner looked at the evidence concerning novelty, usefulness, non-obviousness, proper disclosure, and the evidence pertaining to statutory bar in determining whether a patent application is valid and should therefore be issued as a patent. Now, the counter-argument that was raised by I4I and its supporting amici is that the clear and convincing standard is essential as part of the patent bargain. The patentee, or before the patent issues, the inventor, publicly discloses through the patent his or her invention in exchange for the 20-year term of protection provided by a patent itself. And also, the argument was repeatedly made that the clear and convincing standard is essential in establishing clear title and commercializing patents in the marketplace, that if you didn't have a clear and convincing standard for evidence, that all patents would have a cloud over them, and that this would undermine the ability to obtain financing from venture capitalists or to enter into licenses with companies to manufacture the product, because they themselves would feel uncertain about the status of the property that they'd be investing in. Now, Sotomayor very interestingly concludes her opinion by briefly discussing these arguments and then noting that we're not the ones who should be evaluating these policy arguments, that the statute speaks to the issue, the statute is clear, given the canons of statutory construction. And thus, if these policy concerns are truly valid, then really what Microsoft and its supporting amici should be doing is taking their beef about this clear and convincing standard to Congress and not bringing the issue to the courts. Now, this is an especially salient point given that Congress has constantly been enacting minor statutory tweaks to the 1952 Patent Act ever since Judge Rich's decision in 1984 in the Derek Hoist case. And in all of these little tweaks, it hasn't touched the issue or even changed the language in Section 282. Now, this is very important because some of these tweaks to the patent system were actually adopted to address the problem of bad patents. For instance, Congress created reexamination procedures at the PTO to deal specifically with the concerns about bad patents being issued. And noting this in her opinion, is interesting to observe that Justice Sotomayor used scare quotes to show that she doesn't necessarily agree with this argument, but she's showing how that even if you accept the terms of this argument that the bad patents are being issued, that Congress actually has already addressed this. And it never has expressed disagreement with the Derek Hoist decision from 1984 or even acted to overturn the clear and convincing standard. Now, lastly, my third point that's specific to patent law is a historical point. And for those who might know me or my work, they won't be surprised that I'm going to be making this point because I actually do a lot of research and writing on the history of Anglo-American patent law. Now, it's very interesting that the modern view of what justifies a presumption of validity is that this is rooted in the examination system that was established in the 1836 Patent Act. Again, the argument here is that federal agencies and the officials working these agencies are presumed to do their jobs, and thus courts have to defer to their decision-making when cases are brought before the courts. Now, this argument is the dominant view today among scholars, commentators, and judges. And it explains thus why scholars and Microsoft have been arguing about bad patents as a policy justification for eliminating the clear and convincing standard, or at least for modifying the standard. Because the point here is that the PTO is not doing its job at examination. Bad patents are being issued. And if this is the case, then this undermines the force of this policy justification for the presumption of validity for issued patents. If the federal officials at the PTO are not doing their jobs, they should not be given deference. Now, this is an interesting argument, and it should be part of the policy debate. But I've actually found something of interest in my historical research, and that is I have actually found some evidence of a presumption of validity, or at least a liberal canon favoring patentees in litigation prior to 1836. Now, I discuss this research in my article entitled "Who Cares What Thomas Jefferson Thought About Patents? Reevaluating the Patent Privilege in Historical Context," which was published in 2007 in the Cornell Law Review. Now, the historical research that I present in this article is significant because I actually found courts using canons favoring patents before 1836. Now, the reason why this is important is because under the 1793 Patent Act, which was in force up to the point that Congress enacted the 1836 Patent Act, the U.S. did not have an examination system. It had a registration system. Patents were not being examined. They were simply being issued, and patent validity issues thus were being fought out in the courts. But despite the fact that there was only a registration system, the courts nonetheless were applying canons favoring patentees in patent litigation. Thus, for instance, in 1827, Chief Justice John Marshall, riding circuit, instructed a jury in a patent infringement trial that the patent was to receive, quote, "a liberal common sense construction," end quote. And in 1831, Justice Henry Baldwin, again riding circuit, observed that patents should be looked at by juries as, quote, "a statement of the patentee's right and title," end quote. And the significance of this was that the juries, quote, "will overlook all defects in the mode of setting it out," end quote. Now, even after 1836, when the examination system was adopted and thus became the primary justification for applying a presumption of validity to patents, the 19th century courts still recognized that courts had applied favorable canons of interpretation to patents even before 1836. And the statements from Chief Justice Marshall and Justice Baldwin are not unusual. I found lots of cases and statements by justices expressing these opinions. In other words, the courts were justifying treating patents liberally in favor of patentees, not because they were examined at the PTO, but because they were identifying them as property rights, as title deeds, to use Justice Baldwin's words. Now, this is significant because many other justices, as well as Chief Justice Marshall and Justice Baldwin, in the early 19th century continued to refer to patents as titles. And they employed many other common law property concepts and rhetoric that I found in my research and I present in the article. Now, this was important at that time because this was in contrast to how monopoly franchise grants were construed at the time, and they continue to be construed today. Franchise grants, such as a bridge monopoly, are construed very strictly against the franchisee in favor of the public. But even before 1836, in the early 19th century, patents were conceived as and treated under law as property rights. And justices were repeatedly writing in their opinions and instructing juries when they were riding circuit that patents were not to be treated merely as monopoly grants that would normally deemed to be invalid except for the fact that they may serve social utility. Now, I make this historical observation only for the purpose of noting that as the debate now shifts to Congress, I hope that all of the original policy justifications for the presumption of validity will come into play. As I indicated at the start of this podcast, the Microsoft E-I-4-I decision portended extreme potential ramifications against patents if the Supreme Court had tossed the clear and convincing standard. But it didn't, but it did indicate that Microsoft and its supporting amici can take their arguments to Congress, and it's certainly the case that that will probably happen. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you about the Microsoft E-I-4-I case, and I hope you have a wonderful summer.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.